Let us continue then and finish our chapter on concentration, dharana, chapter 4 in the Yoga of Integral Knowledge. Sri Aurobindo continues, this concentration proceeds by the idea, using thought, form, and names as keys which yield up to the concentrating mind the truth that lies concealed behind all thought, form, and name. For it is through the idea that the mental being rises beyond all expression to that which is expressed, to that of which the idea itself is only the instrument. So if concentration is that mode of awareness where we exclude all other things apart from the thing that we seek, and moving from the near to the far, beginning with the thought which is before us, our chosen idea, we concentrate upon that and allow it to become the sole focus for us. The more we succeed in doing that, then the more the reality that the idea represents begins to merge itself into us. It's like the thought, the idea, is a magnet that draws us towards that, or draws that towards us. It begins with this thought, this chosen idea, but it continues by the familiarity of the form and the name, the form, the rupa, the name, the nama, by which this thing is described within the cosmic consciousness itself. Because all is a manifestation of Brahman, each thing has a fitting form and name so long as it persists, so long as it exists. And for us to come into communion with that requires our identity with it. Hence, this power of concentration. By concentration upon the idea, the mental existence, which at present we are, breaks open the barrier of our mentality and arrives at the state of consciousness, chit, the state of being, sat, the state of power, shakti, of conscious being, and bliss, ananda, of conscious being, to which the idea corresponds, and of which it is the symbol, the movement, and rhythm. It is not a stationary idea. Let us not get the sense that a form is something extracted and sitting apart. It is always part of a movement. Everything is a throb. Everything is vibrating. All is dancing. Concentration by the idea is then only a means, a key to open to us the superconscient planes of our existence. A certain self-gathered state of our whole existence, lifted into that superconscient truth, unity, and infinity of self-aware, self-blissful existence, is the aim and culmination. And that is the meaning we shall give to the term samadhi, this idea of a self-gathered state, chidgana, where the consciousness is massed together, self-aware, self-blissful, compressed in the truth of its own being, chidgana. So to be aware of that is what Sri Aurobindo means by samadhi. Not merely a state withdrawn from all consciousness of the outward, withdrawn even from all consciousness of the inward, into that which exists beyond both, whether as seed of both or transcendent even of their seed state. But a settled existence in the one and infinite, united and identified with it. And this status to remain, whether we abide in the waking condition in which we are conscious of the forms of things, or we withdraw into the inward activity, which dwells in the play of the principles of things, the play of their names and typal forms, or we soar to the condition of static inwardness, where we arrive at the principles themselves, and at the principle of all principles, the seed of name and form. So here, he has a footnote, the waking, dream, and sleep states of the soul. This is a direct reference to the Mandukya Upanishad, which I think we touched upon last time, but let's talk about it again. The principle of all principles, the seed of name and form. The mantra of all mantras is Om. And the first syllable, the A, represents the visible, expanded universe physically before us, Jagritasthana, that which stands in this outward world, the sthula, the outward being, the physical being, Vaishvanara, which is available to all beings, this common universe we all inhabit. The you, of course, is that conceptive, powerful, creative state, which is indrawn, dreaming the universe, which will be extended outwardly. And that is the state of Swapnasthana. Pravivikta, Daijasa, delightful, brilliant. Those are its qualities. But we rise beyond that into the silence, you might say, of the self when we reach that M, A-U-M. And there we are ensconced in Sushupta-sthana, where all to us is Eki-bhuta, oneness of being, Prajnanagana, a mass of knowledge, Anandamaya, whose very nature is bliss. And this, the Mandukya tells us, this is Sarvajna. This is the state in which we know all things inwardly. Sarveshwara, where the supreme, the Antaryaman, the inner controller, moves, dispelling all ignorance, because there is identity, no distinction, as in even when we dream and our conception has a separate life from us and stations itself in the moving universe. Here, in that state, subject and object are the same. But even this is not the last, because there is a fourth state, as we've said before, chaturtham, turiya, that fourth state, which transcends even the transcendent, which incorporates within itself all of these other states of being, indescribable, unnameable. We simply refer to it in a way, without trying to assign to it a specific limited meaning. This Om, all of it together, is a representation of the universe that we see and deal with commonly, but also which we do not see, which transcends our experience, which engulfs us, but with which we are identical. We are cognate with that, can never exist outside of it, and we carry its truth within us. He continues, for the soul that has arrived at the essential samadhi and is settled in it, samadhishta, in the sense the Gita attaches to the word, has that which is fundamental to all experience and cannot fall from it by any experience, however distracting to one who has not yet ascended the summit. It can embrace all in the scope of its being without being bound by any or deluded or limited. So one abides in that. That's the meaning of the term. Abides where things are joined back together. Samadhi means to join together, to link together again. And so is a fitting end of the whole process of yoga, yes, where we come back into conscious oneness with that thing that we seek. Once you have that realization, once the experience extends itself and grips and claims the whole being, then even if you enter into the world again, and there may be clouds of delusion that sweep over you, just like the sunshine burning away all the fog, you will return to your realized state. You cannot long rest in ignorance. You will not be caught up in it again. Not in terms of slavery, not in terms of forgetting what you are, because always you will have the power to reach back inside you and pull forth the secret of your soul. Sri Aurobindo continues here. When we arrive at this state, all our being and consciousness being concentrated, the necessity of concentration in the idea ceases. For there, in that supramental state, the whole position of things is reversed. So here he's talking about us transcending the play of the phenomenal universe, becoming one in true being and true consciousness, which means Sat and Chit, of the famous Sat-Chit Ananda. In that, through the power of concentration, we practice tapas to compress, to restrict our field of awareness so they can reach that state of living oneness with that. And it is that Sat-Chit Ananda which expresses itself multitudinously as the supramental. So, for there, in that supramental state, the whole position of things is reversed. The mind is a thing that dwells in diffusion, in succession, one after the other. There's a temporal play. All things are out here seemingly discrete from each other, but actually there is an abiding oneness that really links things. And whatever passage of time you may measure, it is always within the one moment, the only moment that is. Therefore, it has to concentrate on a single idea, a single subject of meditation, a single object of contemplation, a single object of will in order to possess or master it. And this it must do to at least the temporary exclusion of all others. Hence, concentration. Forget all the rest, stick with this. But that which is beyond the mind and into which we seek to rise is superior to the running process of the thought, superior to the division of ideas. The divine is centered in itself, and when it throws out ideas and activities, does not divide itself or imprison itself in them, but holds them and their movement in its infinity. Undivided, its whole self is behind each idea and each movement, and at the same time, behind all of them together. Isha Upanishad, the first verse, the sixth verse, the seventh verse. Held by it, each spontaneously works itself out, not through a separate act of will, but by the general force of consciousness behind it. If to us there seems to be a concentration of divine will and knowledge in each, it is a multiple and equal and not an exclusive concentration. And the reality of it is rather a free and spontaneous working in a self-gathered unity and infinity. The soul, which has risen to the divine samadhi, participates in the measure of its attainment in this reversed condition of things, the true condition. For that which is the reverse of our mentality is the truth, not divided, but one, always expansive, always equal, each thing being unique, is nevertheless equal to all others. There is no essential superiority, there is essential identity. It is for this reason that, as is said in the ancient books, the man who has arrived at self-possession attains spontaneously, without the need of concentration in thought and effort, the knowledge or the result which the idea or the will in him moves out to embrace. And you can find resonant passages to that in the Chandogya Upanishad, the Katha Upanishad, the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, the Mundaka Upanishad, Taittiriya Upanishad, and the Bhagavad Gita. To arrive, then, at this settled divine status must be the object of our concentration. The first step in concentration must be always to accustom the discursive mind to a settled, unwavering pursuit of a single course of connected thought on a single subject, and this it must do undistracted by all lures and alien calls on its attention. So we remember the preliminaries that the Yoga Sutras impose on the aspirant. First, you deal with your outward going nature, with the yamas, and then you deal with your inner environment, with the niyamas. Then you learn how to sit quietly in composure. Then you regulate your breath so that you're not frantic, that your breath is deep and sustained and harmonic, calming the life energies in you. Then you begin to pull your consciousness away from outward distractions, senses, and the grip of emotions and thoughts, and that's pratyahara. And then as you go inside, you are now in the inner portion of your being. And now you begin to exercise the power of dharana, of concentration. And you fix your attention on this thing that you love. It could be a mantra, it could be japa, it could be an ishta devata, an image that is important or significant to you, whatever it is, you zone in on that. You don't let it go. You hold fast to it. And in the holding fast, you begin to come into an alliance with it. It supports you and your psychological environment so that you can focus more and more entirely. And eventually you have this breakthrough, where what you seek becomes you. In fact, all disappears, and there's only this brilliant seed, this bija that Sri Aurobindo has referred to, shining with all of reality behind it, as if what is infinite in space and time has shown itself to you in this spark of consciousness. And into that you proceed. With difficulty, you try to capture it because you're full of zeal, but it eludes you. It moves here, it moves there. You can't quite capture it. The secret is to slow down, take a deep breath, relax slightly, and let it come to you. Let it slide into your being. This thing that you seek, seeks you. The hound of heaven has found you. So become one with that, and the necessity for thought, for connected thought, disappears. So this then becomes the state of dhyana, which advances you to deeper and deeper identification with that reality and leads you through samadhi with form into samadhi without form and into sublime oneness with that which transcends all. So, back to his paragraph here. The first step in concentration must be always to accustom the discursive mind to a settled, unwavering pursuit of a single course of connected thought on a single subject. And this it must do undistracted by all lures and alien calls on its attention. Number one, such concentration is common enough in our ordinary life, but it becomes more difficult when we have to do it inwardly without any outward object or action on which to keep the mind. In other words, normally we have an outer support. Now we have to look for the inner support. Yet this inward concentration is what the seeker of knowledge must affect. And there's a footnote. In the elementary stages of internal debate and judgment, vitarka and vichara, for the correction of false ideas and arrival at the intellectual truth. So in vitarka, there's this following out specifically of the idea, and vichara, the dwelling upon it, the reflection more deeply upon it. Two successive movements in this process in which the mind is calming and quietening and focusing itself. Nor must it be merely the consecutive thought of the intellectual thinker, whose only object is to conceive and intellectually link together its conceptions. It is not, except perhaps at first, a process of reasoning that is wanted, so much as a dwelling, so far as possible, on the fruitful essence of the idea, which, by the insistence of the soul's will upon it, must yield up all the facets of its truth. Now, if you've been reading Sri Aurobindo for a long time, you're aware that he had a deep love and respect for Swami Vivekananda. And when Swami Vivekananda gave his first thoughts and lectures and writings on Raja Yoga, the first thing he said was that all our knowledge is based upon our experience. Sri Aurobindo has often made that point. It is one of the primary tenets of the life divine. And it differentiates him from Shankara, who does not insist that it is the enlightened experience of the sage that gives knowledge, but the coherence of the philosophic argument with the revelations present in the Upanishads. That is knowledge to Shankara. Sri Aurobindo has said, no. Finally, we must see that it is the reverberating realization, the experience of reality, that is the great knowledge. And that is when we become identical with it. So we don't think of it as an object anymore, but we are one with it, and we know it from inside out, just like we know our own emotions and our own thoughts. So this is what Swami Vivekananda began with. And you can see that in many passages in Sri Aurobindo's treatment of the Yoga of Integral Knowledge, he refers again and again back to Swami Vivekananda's primary writings on this. And, by the way, however it fell into his hands, Patanjali's Yoga Sutras had been of no concern to India's intellectuals for several centuries until he picked them up again and popularized them in the late 19th century, which was ironical because he gave the Yoga Sutras a Vedantic twist that they don't possess themselves and launched the renewed popularity of the Yoga Sutras. So, of that more later, we can speak of it, but I just offered as a footnote along the way here. So, this fruitful essence of the idea, this is your experience of it. When the thing begins to tell you about itself, the essence begins to reveal itself to you because your scrutiny of it gives it the necessary sanction to teach you. The student in the Upanishads is always trying to get the guru, the teacher, to reveal, the acharya, to reveal the truth. And the acharya, the guru, never does until he's sure of the sincerity of the seeker. Once he is, he whispers that truth in his ear. He imparts that knowledge. And just so with this, the thing that you seek with your ardent heart, your focused mind, all of your energy in great tapasya, when it is sure, it gives itself to you. As the Upanishad says, the self offers itself to whom it chooses. Once you've proven that you're the one, then it says, I'm yours. It's beautiful. Thus, if it be the divine love that is the subject of concentration, it is on the essence of the idea of God as love that the mind should concentrate in such a way that the various manifestation of the divine love should arise luminously, not only to the thought, but in the heart and being and vision of the sadhaka. The thought may come first and the experience afterwards, but equally, the experience may come first and the knowledge arise out of the experience. Afterwards, the thing attained has to be dwelt on and more held till it becomes a constant experience and finally the dharma or law of the being. And dharma from dhr means to hold fast. It has to be dwelt on more and more and held till it becomes a constant experience. So it becomes the law of your nature to be in that. It would be a movement incomprehensible to leave the state of realization, to come wandering back into the ignorance as if, well, done with that. This is the process of concentrated meditation. But a more strenuous method is the fixing of the whole mind in concentration on the essence of the idea only, so as to reach not the thought knowledge or the psychological experience of the subject, but the very essence of the thing behind the idea. So, step number one is to stop the discursive mind, get it connected. Step number two is to get to the essence of the thing. In this process, thought ceases and passes into the absorbed or ecstatic contemplation of the object, or by emerging into it in an inner samadhi. If this be the process followed, then subsequently the state into which we rise must still be called down to take possession of the lower being, to shed its light, power, and bliss on our ordinary consciousness. So he's suggesting here that we have to retain the ability to ascend and descend, that the state of wakefulness must become natural, sahaja. And what descends? Light, power, and bliss. This is again an index to how we typically experience it. It's not casually written, because most often when we seek the higher consciousness, we are suffused first with peace, which, making the being calm, permits us to feel and experience the light as it cascades down from above. Following the light's importation into our nature, then we feel the power come behind, and a great Shakti takes possession. But first we've been made calm and luminous before the power installs itself. Then finally, we can hold the experience of delight, of ananda. So, for otherwise, we may possess it, as many do, in the elevated condition or in the inward samadhi. But we shall lose our hold of it when we awake or descend into the contacts of the world. And this truncated possession is not the aim of an integral yoga. No, we must succeed in having this consciousness here in life, in every passing moment, in all the forms that come before us. We must not be dissuaded from the recognition of that one reality in all forms. A third process is neither at first to concentrate in a strenuous meditation on the one subject, nor in a strenuous contemplation of the one object of thought vision, but first to still the mind altogether. This may be done by various ways. One is to stand back from the mental action altogether, not participating in, but simply watching it, sakshi, until, tired of its unsanctioned leaping and running, it falls into an increasing and finally an absolute quiet. This is interesting, because the sakshi, the witness, is the Purusha. And the Purusha can do more than witness. It can also sanction. It can, as Anumanta, say, yes, go forward. But here, he's saying no. Unsanctioned leaping is not permissible. No habit of the past gets to control. Now, this witness consciousness simply sees, unidentified with the play. That leads to the calmness, to the stilled mind. Another is to reject the thought suggestions, to cast them away from the mind whenever they come, and firmly hold to the peace of the being which really and always exists behind the trouble and riot of the mind. A wonderful discovery. Now, you remember that Sri Aurobindo in 1908 in Baroda actually did both at the direction of Lele, his momentary teacher, who said, sit and simply watch. And you'll see thoughts circling, trying to come into you from outside, from this whole universal mind. When they come, stop them. Don't let them in. Sri Aurobindo did that. He did both. First, he watched. He had never noted their presence before, that they really do come from outside, and we think that we engender all of this thought process when actually these thoughts are universally circulating in the mental plane, looking for a recipient mind into which to enter, and we attract them through our intellectual antennae. So if we refuse to attract them, and when they come through force of habit, we stop them from entering, they stop coming. This happened for Sri Aurobindo. He says it took him 3 days. Really, it took him a few minutes, but to make it entire took him 3 days. There might be a biographical comparison there between Sri Aurobindo and Sri Ramana Maharshi. We'll leave that unexamined for the moment. Remind me. When this secret peace is unveiled, a great calm settles on the being, and there comes usually with it the perception and experience of the all-pervading silent Brahman, everything else at first seeming to be mere form and eidolon. On the basis of this calm, everything else may be built up in the knowledge and experience, no longer of the external phenomena of things, but of the deeper truth of the divine manifestation. Ordinarily, once this state is obtained, strenuous concentration will be found no longer necessary. A free concentration of will, using thought merely for suggestion and the giving of light to the lower members, will take its place. There's a note. This subject will be dealt with more in detail when we come to the yoga of self-perfection. And of course, that's many hundreds of pages later in his writing. And we can see, perhaps eventually, how thoroughly he deals with this topic there, if he remembers to take it up quite like he wrote it here. This will then insist on the physical being, the vital existence, the heart and the mind, remolding themselves in the forms of the divine, which reveal themselves out of the silent Brahman. So light becomes thought, which is then massaged into the members. This idea of will, this is a central aspect of the supramental consciousness. Because if we think of it as expressive of the reality of Satchit-Ananda, the positive way in which the Supreme Reality delivers itself, still, the supramental is a knowledge that has the power of effectuation, a will that is cognate with the knowledge, so that what it sees, it enforces, because there is no opposition, there is no ignorance to be an act of demurral. There is only recognition of the authentic insistence, Ishita, Aishwarya, of this higher nature, this higher power of this one being that wants to achieve something, and so all says yes. This, he writes, of course, here in 1916, and never revised it, but after his experiences from 1920 on, I think he might have recast this had he the full opportunity to prepare a volume on the yoga of integral knowledge. He's only partly touched this here and there. By swifter or slower degrees, according to the previous preparation and purification of the members, they will be obliged with more or less struggle to obey the law of the will and its thought suggestion, so that eventually the knowledge of the divine takes possession of our consciousness on all its planes, and the image of the divine is formed in our human existence, even as it was done by the old Vedic sadhakas. For the integral yoga, this is the most direct and powerful discipline. So you see, there is here this passage from the supramental, in a sense, directly through mind into the waiting members below to effect the transformation. Later he would see that it is desirable, but perhaps not permissible, because first there has to be harnessed an over-mental consciousness. That has to be won as the region which allows the massed light of the supramental to be transmitted into the then waiting mind, which can placidly install it in all the rest of the members of the being. So that element, the overmind, was missing from this stage of the development of the yoga of integral knowledge. This idea that the divine would take possession of the human instrument, this is absolutely Vedic, in the image of Indra and Kutsa riding together in the chariot. It's also very much part of the entire tantric tradition, the descent of the mother goddess, the great Devi, into all the various centers of the being, her imposition of her own nature, chakra after chakra after chakra, until finally she seizes upon the human body, all the ignorance of the human being erased, and the whole being sublated into a physical representation of her. She now owns this body. This is part of the tantric path as well. But this idea of the divine descending and holding this nature in a representative human form is the beginning, but there is also the idea of the divine holding a larger humanity through the community, through the awakening and establishing of a group soul as it moves in concourse through this universe, moving from region to region, carrying light and felicity where it goes, teaching through example, sharing through identity. This is a wonderful possibility, and the close of the Veda sings that to us. Come and be your mantra. The revealed word which materializes itself. All right, so next week, dear friends, we'll take chapter 5 into consideration. Renunciation. What does it mean for us? So something from Savitri. Let's be daring. To book 10, the book of the double twilight. Canto 4, the dream twilight of the earthly real. We'll start on page 664. A mighty transformation came on her. A halo of the indwelling deity. The immortal's luster that had lit her face and tinted its radiance in her body's house, overflowing, made the air a luminous sea. In a flaming moment of apocalypse, the incarnation thrust aside its veil. A little figure in infinity yet stood and seemed the eternal's very house, as if the world's center was her very soul, and all wide space was but its outer robe. A curve of the calm hauteur of far heaven, descending into earth's humility, her forehead span vaulted the omniscient's gaze. Her eyes were two stars that watched the universe. The power that from her being's summit reigned, the presence chambered in lotus secrecy, came down and held the center in her brow, where the mind's lord in his control room sits. There, throned on concentration's native seat, he opens that third mysterious eye in man, the unseen's eye that looks at the unseen, when light with a golden ecstasy fills his brain, and the eternal's wisdom drives his choice, and eternal will seizes the mortal's will. It stirred in the lotus of her throat of song, and in her speech throbbed the immortal word. Her life sounded with the steps of the world's soul, moving in harmony with the cosmic thought. As glides God's Son into the mystic cave, where hides his light from the pursuing gods, it glided into the lotus of her heart, and woke in it the force that alters fate. It poured into her navel's lotus depth, lodged in the little life nature's narrow home. On the body's longings grew heaven rapture's flower, and made desire a pure celestial flame. Broke into the cave where coiled world energy sleeps, and smote the thousand-hooded serpent force that blazing towered and clasped the world self above, joined matter's dumbness to the spirit's hush, and filled earth's acts with the spirit's silent power. Thus changed, she waited for the word to speak. Eternity looked into the eyes of death, and darkness saw God's living reality. Fear not, she is always merciful and kind. Namaste. Jai Ma.